One, music, art, health, science, biology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. And sure, what is happening too? You want to find things that aren't right, your office and solutions. And now, the host of that segment, Todd Nicolaus.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Evident Footprints. I'm your host, Don Nicolaus. And if it seems like we started a little bit late, well, we did, unless you were expecting us to come on in another 5 minutes or so, then we're early. We gave some of you a chance to go to the bathroom or get something to drink. So it always works out in the end. We've got a great show for you coming up in a moment. In fact, this is already a great show, so just kidding. Before bringing our guest on board, I just wanted to mention that I received an email from the GOP candidate, Albert Howard, who has been, let's say, a thorn in the side of the officials in the state of New Hampshire. He's been trying to get the recall underway, and they've been stalling and stalling and stalling. He's paid $55,000 for that recount. I called it recall. I should have said recount. The recount of the New Hampshire presidential primary vote. Now, Mr. Howard is from the state of Michigan, and he has been sending out to a group of people updates as to the official count that's taking place and or not taking place. And today he hand-delivered. In fact, most of the communications have been hand-delivered, so they cannot be explained away as lost in the mail or I didn't see that. It didn't come to my desk. William Gardner, the Secretary of State of New Hampshire, has been getting these hand-delivered messages from Albert Howard, and I would like to read today's message. He says, "Dear Mr. Gardner, under the authority of New Hampshire's election law, or, if necessary, New Hampshire's right-to-know law, I respectfully request the recount immediately begin to include a count of the all ballots that have been returned from the towns and cities, including, but not necessarily limited to, the unused, uncast ballots and the spoiled ballots. Time is of the essence. Your immediate attention to this matter is essential. Thank you for your cooperation. Very truly yours, Albert B. Howard." Now, my take on this letter is that Mr. Howard is interested in preventing any kind of a stall from taking place before Super Tuesday, which is coming up in 3 days. Here we are, February 2nd on the East Coast, or February 1st, depending where you are in the country. And this election is supposed to take place in 22 states on February 5th, next Tuesday. Obviously, they are trying to hide the fact that there may be an overturning of the winner, or that further corruption, which is taking place, fraudulent voting, in other words, fraudulent counting of the votes, both electronically and of the ballots, may be exposed and have some impact on the next 22 states. Mr. Howard has a point. He is running for the office of the presidency. He did pay $55,000 for this recount, and they've collected the money, and here he is now, well over 20 days after the initial request for the recount. In fact, the recount was to begin on the 8th of January. Here we are now, February 2nd, and the recount has not begun. In addition to that, and you can see this on my website, I have posted a YouTube video that was taken by a lady who went to New Hampshire, and all the ballot venues that she could possibly gather some tape showing the delivery of the boxes out of a van by two gentlemen who don't go by their real names as they're traveling to the polling places where the votes are to be counted. These boxes have removable sealing tape. Now, the tape is supposed to seal the boxes, so the boxes cannot be open. They would, by all means and under normal circumstances, be opened by slicing the tape with a knife or some sharp implement, a box cutter maybe, although we have to watch box cutters these days because someone carrying a box cutter might be construed to be a terrorist. But they can open these boxes using some sharp implement that would break the seal. She demonstrated on tape that you can actually remove the seal and reapply it to the cardboard numerous times. In fact, many of the boxes are arriving in such poor condition and with distorted lids. The lids are closed, but the tape has a loop in it or a hump in it where it doesn't even make contact with a large portion of the box. And then they secured this with Scotch tape as if to say, we were really concerned about this one. This one, for some reason, wasn't remaining sealed. They found slits in the tops of the boxes, on the bottoms of the boxes, or on the sides. And it was very easy to take ballots out and replace them with more desirable ballots. Let's say if you wanted to skew the vote in a particular direction, you could remove all the ballots and just merely insert the ballots that you wanted in there. And this is the type of corruption that is documented on tape, that it has gone on. These boxes did not leave the polling place in the manner in which they have been returned. In fact, in many instances, from the state highway patrol vehicles to the venue, they have changed from being sealed to unsealed. If this doesn't get your ire up, I don't know what will. It's gotten mine up, and many other people are reporting this. We thank Albert Howard for his investing $55,000 into the recount. Now, Mr. Gardner and Mr. David Scanlon, I guess he's the Deputy Secretary of State, who is right now being blamed for all of this. He's the one orchestrating the obfuscation of the votes. It's time you get down to business and do your job and count the votes. And we mean count the votes. There should be no hanging chads, as I understand, because they've marked these ballots. But there are already stories of people marking arrows and putting dots on certain places and then marking another vote with a more solid type of circle. This is more shenanigans like what went on in Florida several years ago when the election was stolen from Al Gore. And the election with John Kerry was a farce. I really don't care who won the election, but it was obvious that we had corruption then, and we have corruption now. We have a foreign company making these machines also. We have basically people from foreign countries controlling our elections. Something is dead wrong in our government. Something is very, very sick in the way these people are operating. And our country needs a doctor, and these people need a psychological examination. It's just rampant criminality is what it is. So, that said, I would not take up any more time tonight on that issue, but look for some updates next week. You can go to my website, directlightproductions.com, and I've got some new video posted there. I have the pictures of the Ron Paul rally from Winter Park, Florida, also posted on the photos page. and it's kind of convenient. The whole album is laid out. When you click on the album that you would like to see, you click on that, and it opens up a whole page, and you have the convenience of a slideshow. And when you click on that, it turns the pictures for you. So you don't even have to use your mouse or your cursor to scroll down the page. It's very simple, very easy. Also, I posted some photos, military photos that were taken of Ground Zero on 9/11/2001, a helicopter that was flying around Manhattan taking anomalous pictures of the destruction. And I will have a forthcoming DVD documentary talking about the contents of those pictures. Now, you can see the pictures for yourselves, but when I do this DVD, I'm going to be revealing some very startling facts about what's contained in the pictures, and many of you will be shocked. So I urge you to go there. Also, read some of the updates either in articles, archives, or the news. And you can spend quite a bit of time there at looking at the amount of content that I've got posted on the website right now. With that, I would like to bring our guest on board. He's with us usually every Friday in one manner or another. And because of the hectic week last week, we took Friday off. I apologize to anyone that was waiting for a live show. But we made it here tonight, and I'm going to introduce to the listening audience my guest, Mr. Jim Murray. Jim, are you there? Well, I'm not hearing Jim right now.
Hey, can you
Jim,
hear me?
Are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Now I can hear you. Yes. Yes, now I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I can hear you fine now, but before it was terrible.
Okay, very good. How are you, Jim?
Not too bad, actually. How are you doing, Don?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good. I'm a bit angered and disgusted with how this election is moving along here. You know, we have the media is scowling and smirking at Ron Paul, and so are the I'm not happy about that because I'm not that stupid to not recognize what's going on. You know, they were railroading these candidates through their little spin machine, trying to manufacture a candidate, and it's very corrupt what's going on. So, other than that, I'm fine.
Well. I know you had a rough time last week, and you were exhausted when you got back, so it's good to hear your perky voice again.
Thank you. Yeah, I was pretty tired. You know, it was a long drive, too. Let's see. 2 weeks ago, Jim, you and I were discussing a lot of technology, and for the new listener's sake, or those that may have forgotten what we were talking about, we had a pretty lengthy discussion about some of the technology, the wireless technology that Nikola Tesla had invented and was experimenting with. And I know we wanted to tie up some loose ends, which we often do. There's just not enough time in one show to discuss all of these topics. And I wanted to revisit some of that. We don't have to rehash all the other stuff, but we're just trying to bring the listeners up to date that we had talked about the wireless. And Tesla had spoken about the strong possibility that he would be picking up communication from other realms, let's say, out there in space or out there further out in the universe. And I know that we could talk a long time about that, but you had some points that I know you wanted to make in regard to that.
Well, that's true. And in preparation for that, let me just backtrack a little bit and make an interesting comment regarding modes of transmission, you might say, which are not generally thought of. There was a gentleman back in the New York area in the 60s by the name of Clave Baxter, who did a lot of experiments with plants. And from his experiments, he deduced that there is a force which is akin to life on Earth and capable of instantaneous transmission of emotion and other stimuli anywhere in space instantaneously and without interference. And the military had played around with this, and I know we went into it to some extent in an earlier show. The only reason I bring it up is because we seem to think, simply because of the way we're programmed, I guess, that the only node of communication that would serve us through the media of space would be radio. And this is very interesting, considering the fact that even to reach the nearest galaxy would take thousands of years for a radio message traveling at the speed of light. And we just naturally assume that because we do everything with radio waves, that everybody else does. And the reason I bring this up in regard to Tesla is because of the fact that later on in his career, Tesla was messing around with things which were very, very far from radio. One of the aspects of this work began with the wireless work that he was doing, which I think we explained in an earlier show, that wireless, in Tesla's sense, did not mean wireless the way we mean it today, with handheld transceivers and radio-controlled devices and things of that nature. Tesla was using one-wire transmission mechanisms very early on in his work, and then what he actually did was he substituted the planet itself for one of the wires, and therefore had true wireless by energizing and changing the gradient of the electric field on Earth. He was able to broadcast simultaneously to any point on the globe and do so with practically no attenuation of signal. But during that phase, he also began to realize that there were other mechanisms, I guess would be a good word, that allowed him to make use of even finer and more subtle forces in the universe for the sake of communication. And my personal belief is that he was actually using streams of ether, which he learned to control electrically. And Tesla did have a name for this. He used to call it radiant energy. And if you look in the Tesla patents, of which there are many, there are several patents which are specifically related to the utilization of radiant energy and receiving signals directly from the ambient medium. And I personally have never had the privilege of experimenting in this realm, but I know people who have. And it's really a very amazing thing when you get the impulse frequency high enough that you begin to have access to a situation where apparently the electrons are literally separated from the charge that they carry, and the charge can then be manipulated free of any mass being involved. And under those conditions, everything is radically different, Don.
Mm-hmm.
Tesla used to liken the situation to a wet tennis ball. If you and I are tossing a tennis ball back and forth and it happens to be wet, it's no big deal. The moisture will actually travel with the ball. But if I suddenly and abruptly change the direction of that ball by smashing it with a tennis racket, and I've actually tried this experiment, it really happens. If you hit that ball hard enough, you can actually watch the water fly off of it, and the ball will leave without the water. And what Tesla was doing in some of his high-voltage, high-frequency impulse oscillators was he was literally tearing the charge right off of the electrons and then just leaving the electrons behind to circulate as normal currents, and began to make use of this incredible ethereal fluid, if you will, for the sake of communication. And this stuff apparently has no attenuation, can travel God only knows how far, and is capable of penetrating almost any object. So with that little bit behind us, and with the possibility that more advanced civilizations use something simpler to this ethereal disturbance that Tesla was messing around with, it's altogether possible that he did reach some intelligent beings, either in our solar system or elsewhere, and possibly had some form of communication with them. Now, I don't remember that Tesla actually made that proclamation himself, but he did mention that he had received signals that he didn't know the origins of, and this happened at a point in time when the planet Mars was very close to Earth, and of course the newspaper people got a hold of this and immediately made the suggestion that since Mars was so close by at that point in time, that obviously Tesla was talking to Martians. But regardless of what was actually happening, if he was receiving signals from an intelligent race somewhere else, it's not at all impossible to assume that not only did he have some kind of an exchange with them, but they may even have taught him more things than he knew already. You stop and think of it, in the latter portion of Tesla's life, he was doing things that are so far out that when we talk about it today, it still raises people's eyebrows. And one begins to wonder just what sort of a person Nikola Tesla really was, that he had the ability to apparently generate an endless source of new ideas, and not only that, but perfect them into working hardware and then utilize them for the purpose of exploring the forces of nature, and to do so with great facility. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I thought you had completed your sentence.
I said to do so with great facility and variety is really pretty amazing.
Well, I was going to say, you must be reading my mind, because I was going to ask a question both for myself and for the listeners to get some insight from you as to whether or not you thought that these experiments and these inventions were a result of him just trying to the next step in a progression of unfolding inventions based upon his earlier work, or was this just his rampant creativity going wild? In other words, were these things that he always contemplated, or did they sort of spring from his prior work? What do you think?
Well, I think it's probably a combination of things. If I'd be allowed to make a comparison between myself and Tesla just for the purpose of making a point, I can tell you that under certain conditions, something really unusual does happen to you, even without communication from another planet. You can reach a point where some kind of a floodgate opens, and you are literally saturated with an endless variety of ideas. I know that when I was living in Michigan and doing my own independent research, this was long before I was married, long before I had some of the problems that I'm faced with today, and I was in a position to literally dedicate myself to only pursuing my work and paying a few bills. I just had times when my mind would open and an ungodly barrage of ideas would come flooding in. And I used to literally sit and write for hours, filling up notebooks with things that I hoped to eventually pursue. Of course, later, when I got more enmeshed in the fray of normal existence, this stuff became impossible because the pressures of life are brought to bear, and you can't follow through on your plans, and then your mind changes and your focus changes, and these channels get shut down. But just imagine a person like Tesla in a position to do this every day with millions of dollars of support at a point in time when all this exploration into the new sciences was going on. It's certainly feasible that even without alien stimulation, he could have just seen such a vista of potential areas of investigation that he would never have lived long enough to do it all.
Yeah, I understand what you mean about you know, things getting in the way of that creative flow. There are times when I'm trying to compile something as simple as a grocery list to go shopping, and the phone rings and the email comes in, and you can't even do that. So imagine, you know, working on that level. And when I get into a creative endeavor, whether I'm preparing to write something, let's say a journalistic work based on research, or I'm about to compose some music or create something, maybe manufacture something like a piece of wood furniture or fix something around the house. If that flow is not there, it makes the work very difficult and makes it very tedious. But when the inspiration flows, it's so important that you have to cut out the or cut off the outside interference. And I'm sure that you've experienced the same things, too.
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, it's very addictive. When you finally get into that state of mind, I don't know how to describe it exactly, but it takes a lot of effort to get there. And once you're there, you're in touch with something which is so seductive in its nature that you really don't want to be disturbed in any way. You don't want to get out of that mode, and you just want to keep on communicating with whatever it is and accessing as much information as you can. And I used to do that regularly, almost like a meditation, every day.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you that it was just amazing how long you could stay in that state. And you would realize the passage of time. It's pretty intense when it happens.
Yeah, I think that intangible you're talking about sometimes is referred to as infinite intelligence. And, you know, you tap into that part of the universe that where that flow is just open. And, you do lose track of time. I can often tell myself, well, I'm going to work on this for another 15 minutes, and then I'm going to take care of something else, some pressing matter. And I'll look up at the clock, and 8 hours have passed, where I've just totally lost track of time. Now, when you love your work, that's very understandable. A lot of people have trouble even comprehending what that's like, because they're not doing the kind of work that they really love. They may be doing a job that pays the bills, or they're maybe planning on making that ultimate shift to something that they really would prefer to do, and yet this is sort of a lesson in life, I guess, in a way, in applying yourself and developing discipline and concentration, and that magical quality comes through all that discipline.
Well, I have to agree with you there.
I guess
that's an experience that's worth striving for. As a matter of fact, I've actually had one or two of those, fairly recently here in Oklahoma, when I would get involved with some engineering work and really be excited about it, and get into the office like 8:30 in the morning, roll up my sleeves, go to the drafting table, and just start designing something, and all of a sudden it's 4:30 and I'm ticked off because there's no more time. It's like, where does the day go? But that doesn't happen too often anymore.
Well,
but I'm sorry, Don, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that in talking about this, I'm sort of answering the question that I asked, or we're both answering it through our agreement. Without leaping to unusually weird conclusions, somehow Tesla was tapping into a higher intelligence, whether it was a direct communication from other beings or whether it was the creator himself. It really doesn't matter. The thing was, the main point is that he did it, and he did it consistently, and it was far beyond the understanding or the average accomplishments of others in the scientific community. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you stop and think about it, the known work that Tesla did, which is extremely voluminous in its own right, just the patent part of that, I think, requires about 700 patents to examine completely. And then, there's all of the experiments and things he did on the side, which he mentioned and talked about in different lectures, but he certainly didn't necessarily expound upon it to its entirety. And then there's the secret stuff that he never bothered to tell anybody about or only hinted at. So when you put all that together, it represents an incredible spectrum of activity and truly a life filled with exploration, activity, and accomplishment. And most of us can't boast anything of that sort whatsoever. And like you say, it doesn't really matter where the stimulus came from. But let's follow up momentarily on the possibility that that he was in contact with something. And let's go out on a limb a little bit further and even assume that that the reporters of the day were not far from the mark when they suggested that perhaps he was communicating with Mars. Mars has always been a subject of great interest, even in my life. And since we're on this topic, Don, there's something that I would like to bring up, which really irks me. When I was a kid, I lived in New Jersey, as you probably know, and many, many times during the course of my younger years, I would hop over to New York City on a subway or a ferry boat or whatever was convenient and make my way to the Museum of Natural History because that was a place that I literally loved. And in conjunction with that museum, of course, was the fabulous Hayden Planetarium. And I won't even tell you what the fate of that place was because it's, in my opinion, an absolute tragedy what they wound up doing to it. But in the old days when it was a beautiful planetarium and a celestial museum, I spent a lot of hours in that facility. And examined all the photographs and the other bits of information that were available, meteorites and stones and things of that nature, which were supposedly from other worlds. And one of the things that struck me the most was the series of photographs made of the planet Mars. Now, I don't know when they were made exactly, but I would guess, earlier in the 1900s, in the 1920s, the 1930s, in that time period when there seemed to be a great interest in this planet, since it's one of our closest neighbors. And they had, of course, huge optical telescopes like Mount Palomar and other observatories where they could get darn good looks at the planet and take excellent photographs. And what I'm leading to here is the fact that Mars has always been known right down through history as the red planet. And the Romans and the Greeks referred to it as the god of war, as you know, because of the red tint of the planet relates it to blood. And the red soil, or whatever you want to call it, of Mars showed up very clearly in these photographs, and so did the curious bands and strange markings of deep green and the polar ice caps all showed up very, very clearly. And I was always enthralled with this. I didn't know whether or not there were canals on Mars, but it was certainly easy to use your imagination to envision the ice caps melting with the coming of spring and the deepening of the green as vegetation began to sprout and lavish in the additional moisture. And I always thrilled at the possibility that eventually we would reach Mars and find forms of life there. Now, what's interesting is you never see the red planet anymore. Isn't it strange that now that we can actually go there with robotic machines and take pictures from orbiting telescopes and the like, that you no longer see the red planet as red? You no longer see these bands of green. And I don't know if you even see the ice caps or not anymore. It seems very strange to me that all of a sudden we are shown a desolate, unbelievably barren area with absolutely nothing to capture our interest whatsoever. And in fact, it's made to look a great deal like the moon. Now, either something really bizarre has happened to the art of photography in the last 40 or so years, or else we're not being shown what's really there. And I'd like you to comment on that, because I know you have ideas in this direction, Don.
Well, my take, I think you and I discussed this several months ago on the show, maybe as many as 4 months ago at least. And we talked about the fact that I was posed a similar question by Bill Ryan and Carrie Cassidy from Project Camelot. Now, they do a series of films which are interview-based with scientists and people who have been in what we would call the black ops programs. And they have seen and experienced things that prior to these interviews would be assumed to have been scripts from The Twilight Zone or The Outer Limits. And Bill asked me the question what my take was on Mars. And I had told him, well, from a metaphysical standpoint, I had seen the surface of Mars, you could say, as a psychic, and I saw grass, and I saw trees and shrubs, I saw plants, and I saw living animals, rodents, and animals that appeared to be very much like our deer, maybe some differences, but I saw water, I saw buildings, not these anomalies that NASA feeds the public that says, well, this is the light reflection of the sunlight and shadows causing something like a 1,500-foot face to appear, or a stadium, or a city that may be partially buried in rubble, or tanks, or even this anomaly of skulls that we're seeing recently. And I described these things to several people over the years, and no one said, well, you're crazy, but they said, how would you know this? There is no proof of this. And now Richard Hoagland, as recently as within the last 2 weeks, came out with an interview in conjunction with Project Camelot. He actually demonstrated photographs that are coming out that indicate that all these things are true. There is green grass. There is vegetation. There are animals. We've seen pictures of tubes. In fact, hopefully you recall me showing you a black and white photo that had some foreign writing on it, even. So these things have been seen, they have been photographed, and what we get from NASA is a cover story. It's definitely meant for public consumption. It is not intended to at all imply that there is life on Mars, yet my take also was that there were people there, that I had seen people there, and there have been people come forward saying that they had been up there, that they had spent 20 years up there working on black ops government programs, and that we went to Mars before we landed on the moon, and we went there with the Russians. Now, at the time, they would have been the Soviets. As early as my take was 1962, and some of these recent interviews with Bill Ryan and Kerry Cassidy refer specifically to 1961. So I was only off by a year. And this is something I had seen at a very young age, in the astral plane. Much like you would if you were to go to sleep and have a dream about something, and it would be very real. I would experience this not only in my dreams, but in a waking state, let's say in meditation or prayer. I would get glimpses of these things, or long streams of connected pictures. And it wasn't imagination. Now, recently, and I say within the last 6 months, I have seen color photographs that look very different from the orange filtered photographs or the painted photographs, the retouched photographs that NASA puts out. So I would have to conclusively say that there is life on Mars, that we are up there on Mars, that we have figured ways to move through wormholes to get there in an instant, as opposed to these stories you hear, well, it'll take 15 years for us to get to Mars. It doesn't take that long. It doesn't even take 15 seconds to get to Mars if you know the right way to get there. Now, I could go on and on, but I'll stop there. You're the guest tonight, so that strike you?
I always appreciate your input on these matters because you have that psychic's point of view, and you also have access to information that I don't have. But it's interesting that you would say that they were up there as early as 1961, because that roundaboutly brings us back to our friend Nikola Tesla again. It really makes us wonder just where they got the technology to put them there. And as you well know, Tesla had talked about his dynamic theory of gravity, which he was going to use to not only build new types of flying machines, but also to debunk Einstein's special theory of relativity. So considering the fact that he was probably murdered, and considering the fact that his most cherished secrets were probably stolen at the time of his death, it's not inconceivable that Tesla put us on Mars, which would really make for a very, very strange epitaph for such a wonderful man, because first he's accused of communicating with beings from Mars, and then his own technology allows us to get there at the cost of his life. Very strange.
Well, you remember the collection of German saucers that were photographed, and actually this is available on the web. There's a whole series of different models, different sizes of discs that the Germans had developed prior to the end of World War II. And there was great suspicion and speculation that they had flown these to the South Pole and to Mars and to the Moon.
Well, I've heard about those things and seen some of the pictures, and of course it's not inconceivable, but it does raise the dander a little bit, because if these things are really going on, it makes you wonder just what else they're hiding from us, you know, and why does it have to be done that way? You know, what is the point of perpetually keeping mankind in the darkness? The thing that ticks me off the most about that is that all these accomplishments are done with our money. You know, they are essentially using the labor pool of the people of Earth to fund all these things, and then they don't even have the decency to share the information of these accomplishments with the people who made it possible. And I don't know how that makes you feel, but I'd like to wring somebody's neck.
Well, that's what their attempt to control the world is all about. You see, if we become empowered with that knowledge and we understand and know those truths, there is nothing for us to fear about our government. They operate from a position of perceived power based upon all the different mechanisms of fear that they impose upon us 24/7. And for us to come to a realization that we are not alone could extricate us from this matrix that we're in. And they're afraid of us finding that out for sure, in other words. And the problem is that there's nothing they can say or do to me that can change my mind about what I know. And I'm sure you feel the same way. It's like you said, you like to wring someone's neck.
Well, and not only that, you know, but it's only common sense that we're not alone. Look at all that real estate out there, hundreds and hundreds of millions of potential planets. You're going to tell me we're the only one with some form of intelligent life? I don't think so.
Well, I would even venture to guess there's probably trillions of planets. You know, we're seeing a microcosm of the universe. We're seeing a very limited amount of what is out there. And from the Hubble photographs that they release occasionally, you know, we're seeing different galaxies on film. And we're not really shown the path to get to those galaxies. How much do you think they really know that we're not being told? So rather than rely upon them for the information, we're better off seeking the answers ourselves.
Well, that's what I've always tried to do. And that's what really makes for true discovery. Because if you rely on the powers that be, you know, all you're going to get are crumbs. You know that.
And, yes.
It's not very satisfying.
Well, are you aware, Jim, of any inventions or any technologies that Tesla had definitely developed that have totally been suppressed from the public consciousness?
I would have to say that the stuff that I'm aware of that falls into that category the most would be his work on gravity, which we have at least mentioned, and the and the ethereal work, which I mentioned tonight, probably for the first time, the radiant energy stuff. I definitely feel that nobody wants us messing in those areas. And it's very clear to me that that's the case. I remember back in the 50s when I first got interested in this stuff, it just seemed as normal to me as apple pie that there should be a way to artificially produce a gravitational field and use it as a means of propelling a vehicle. And I did a lot of research in those days, best I could, without the Internet. And there were companies that were actually working on this stuff and talking about it openly. Nowadays, all that's underground. You can't find companies that are outwardly talking about the work that they're doing in those areas. And that in itself seems to be a giveaway to me that they don't want us thinking about it. They don't want us wondering about it. And whatever is going on or has been accomplished is not being shared with us at all. And well, that's fine because, you know, the way the world is unfolding now, we have literally tens of thousands of very sharp, very intuitive, very dedicated people all over the world that are investing their time and their money in investigating these things on their own. And they're sharing their results best they can. And they may be many years behind the secret ops programs that are being propelled by our government, but they're getting things done. And sooner or later, all this stuff is going to come out. And it should be very interesting to find out what these people in power will have to say when they're caught with their pants down. I think it'll happen eventually, God willing.
Well, we found out what Bill Clinton had to say when he got caught with this pandemic. The most brilliant thing he could say was, "It depends on what the meaning of the word is." Oh, you know, you brought something to mind, Jim. I'm fairly certain that you're familiar with the work of John Hutchison from Canada. Hutchison effect.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
My understanding from hearing a few interviews and reading about some of his work, or reading transcripts of interviews, was that Boeing was testing some of his research in, obviously, aircraft, but I think a space context. Boeing, as we know it, as the taxpayers and the people that buy plane tickets, see Boeing as a transportation company. But they are involved in many of the black ops programs with the government, and Hutchison himself has referred to that fact. And very recently, and this is really not to change the subject, but there's something in this accident which led to his discovering this technology, that he and Dr. Judy Wood have come to the conclusion that 9/11 and the implosion of the World Trade Center towers, 1 and 2, were definitely evidenced by direct energy weapons. In fact, the phenomenon is still occurring today. In other words, they shot in, and I had described seeing a pulse of energy with accompanying light leave a helicopter that was flying at the level of the roof of the first tower to fall. And after seeing this flash, the helicopter took off out of the way of the building, and the building immediately began falling. Twice I saw that on Rick Siegel's video, 9/11 Eyewitness. And I know it wasn't my imagination. It was the view from the opposite end of the Hudson River that was not shown to the public. They showed us the view looking toward the Hudson River. And it was blocked by all these skyscrapers in Manhattan and the smoke. Now, I found it very interesting that these two scientists worked together, Dr. Judy Wood being a mechanical engineer and John Hutchison being a physicist and in electromagnetics and those types of phenomena. Would you care to comment on that premise or that conclusion that they came to?
Well, I really, this is the first time I've ever heard that, to be honest with you, but I have looked at some of the films concerning 9/11 that some of my friends out east had in their possession, and the one thing I can definitely tell you is there was something absolutely strange about the way those buildings went down, and it certainly wasn't due to catastrophic failure due to the heat, because that would have been that damage would have been left on the upper floors, and it had all the signature, in my opinion, of a detonation that was pre-planned. You could even see the beams flying out in the debris, and if you've ever been around steel structures, you know that unless they're cut with dead cord or something of that sort, they don't all come out pre-cut to the same size, you know. They fall in a crumpled tangle of steel still joined together. But this building looked like it was literally taken apart, and that was my comment on the whole thing. And then after the two buildings went down, the other thing that was interesting, which nobody seems to talk about, is several hours later, all of a sudden, Building 7 just decides to collapse in the same manner. And there were comments caught on tape of people saying that it's time to, I forget the exact word that they use, but it's time to detonate Building 7.
They said pull it.
Pull it, that's what it was, yeah. Almost as if it was a command
Larry
post.
Silverstein.
So,
That was Larry Silverstein, who was the leaseholder. He was the one that made that comment, that the fire department said, well, you know, we don't think we can contain this fire, and there's been such tremendous loss of life and damage. And he said, well, pull it, which is the lingo they use in demolition for bring the building down.
Right. And, of course, that means that the firemen ran in a moment's notice, placed charges strategically all around the building at the right points, and then went outside and detonated it, and it all came down in an expert manner just on time. No possibility that it could have been pre-wired, you know.
Yes, and it was just a fluke that the CIA had an office in that building, you know. And they kept all these financial records of these corrupt activities that Richard Andrew Grove had been sounding the alarm about months before the, 9/11, over which he lost his job as well. So, you know, there are plenty of anomalies, but I thought you would be interested in hearing that they had come to the conclusion, and this is based upon what's still happening there today, that this energy
that.
Has
what does,
lingered.
What does that mean?
Well,
in
other words, there were still anomalous occurrences on the property. And some of, you know, they cleaned the mess up right away. They took everything. There was a rumor that a large portion of the debris had been taken to a hangar at one of the local airports and hidden there, and that some of it had been shipped off to China to be recycled. And in fact, they had some months ago, they had announced that they had launched a ship which was built from the metal which was recycled from the World Trade Center. And I don't know if I buy that. I think that was just a folk story that they put out there for those in the military to you know, somehow this ship was going to be a memorial. Well, what did they do with the people that died? They made a war machine out of that metal, and the building was turned to powder. It didn't crumble like a concrete structure would crumble normally. It was pulverized to powder, and yeah, it shows that the method through which it was brought down, or what instigated it, the fall, was probably a very highly secretive technology. And John Hutchison himself said that the government is already aware of that technology, and they have been experimenting with it at Los Alamos Labs, as well as Boeing, and that even though he discovered it accidentally, and keep in mind, Hutchison is also a proponent of Tesla's work. He was a student of Tesla's research, and he stumbled across what's called the Hutchison effect through that work. Now, Judy Wood probably had come to the same conclusion, and I don't know who solicited who, but I would venture to guess, since she was so heavily involved in that whole investigation, she may have been the one to approach Hutchison to ask his opinion. Things like metal that was cooked from the inside out. Very unusual way to see steel. I'm going to be posting the pictures. I have some pictures of this evidence. I'm going to post it on my website for anyone who's interested in looking at it. I'll be putting it in an album on my photos page. And you're welcome to go look there too, Jim.
Yeah, I would
you can see. And I'll make it a point to the whole story. There's, like you said earlier, you know, there are just so many things to do. You can't do everything. But it's my intention to put this out there. It's very, very important. Also, I'll just add here before, you know, we wrap up the show. About a week and a half, maybe 2 weeks ago, there was another World Trade Center video that came out. This is a new video that's analyzing the TV coverage, and it shows an airplane flying into the first tower, and as the plane is flying into the tower, okay, it's making a hole. It's opening up the tower, cutting it like a hot butter. And as a certain portion of the wings go through the building, all of a sudden the building repairs itself. When you look at this in stop action, you freeze, and then you go a couple of frames in advance. You can see the wing go into the building, and then the building closes up to regular building. It implies that the image of a plane is nothing more than a holographic insertion into the film. Very compelling video. Extremely compelling. And this one I'm also going to post on my website as well. Just mind-blowing. But it's the case is unraveling is what's happening. You know, they set up a commission to avoid any trial of sorts, but it was murder, and it should be treated like a murder investigation. And yes, there may have been some foreign entities. I'm sure Israel played a part in this, their intelligence agency, the Mossad, and they're hand in glove with our government, and a lot of corruption. So, yes, there were some foreign participants, but it wasn't a foreign attack. That's what I would say. There's too much technology. You can't tell me some camel jockeys in northern Afghanistan had all this wherewithal to cause so much destruction so completely. and be the precursor to the bridge collapse in Minneapolis several months ago. It's too advanced for these people. I'm sorry.
Well, I kind of agree with you there. It's something Americans shouldn't let go of, though, because if there's going to be any possibility of saving our country and getting it back to what it used to be, all this filth has to be dragged out from under the carpets. And believe me, there's mountains of it in there. And we as Americans better wake up, because the clock is ticking, and I don't know what these people have in mind except for world domination, but if we don't do something about it and change our way of thinking concerning these events and other things that are going on, I think we're going to be in a very sorry plight. It won't take long for it to happen either.
Mm-hmm. Well, as usual, Jim, this has been very enlightening, and I probably did too much talking tonight, but it turned out like it did. So we can pick up again next week, and maybe you can surprise us with what you'd like to bring to the table. We can certainly continue this discussion. It shows me that I have a lot more research to do on these topics, and I would like to see if there aren't some things that we could bring up. I would like to get into discussion of what type of energy devices would benefit the planet right now. What would be the least dangerous and the most productive in terms of assisting the ecology in healing itself and maybe adhering more to universal law and setting us back on our course. If you can think about those things over the week, maybe that's something we could talk about. What do you say?
Well, that's something I think about every day, so that won't be very difficult for me. I'll put together a little outline on that subject for you, no problem.
Okay. Well, I want to do a quick shout-out to some folks here. I neglected to do that earlier in the show. Michael in New York, thank you. Also, John in California, actually up the road from BBS Radio. John's been kind of quiet lately, but I know he listens religiously to this show. Marianne in Arkansas. We are praying for Rick Stanley and a good outcome to his case. And just want to let you know that we haven't forgotten Rick and Pam, that we know that they're going to have a good outcome. Also, my regular listeners, Karen, Bob, and Bill, David, Zachariah, Crenshaw, Sheila, Jill, and the general, always we appreciate you listening in. We got Ed in New Jersey, Peter and Maria in Florida, Fred in Florida. Oh, we got people all over the place. Rick in Colorado, hope you're listening tonight. Or if you are, hello. Folks, you've been listening to Evident Footprints, and our guest tonight has been Nikola Tesla's mentor, let's say. My good friend Jim Murray, author, scientist, inventor, teacher, lecturer, and visionary, and sometimes comedian. And Jim, I want to thank you for being on the show. I'll see you next week at the same time.
It'll be a pleasure.
Folks, you've been listening to Evident Footprints, and we're going to say goodnight, and we'll see you next Monday. Be sure to tune in. Also, I'll be on the Wednesday afternoon TNT News Hour. Hope to see you there. Have a good night. God bless.